you act like you never made a mistake. Serve up advice that you never be able to take.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do.
I'm afraid of where you're going.
The song you're hearing is called For Your Consideration by the singer Maggie Rose. People used to call her country singer Maggie Rose, but even though she's a regular at the Grand Ole Opry, she's not really a country singer anymore. She's been through a lot of changes since she started her career in Nashville as a teenager, backed by one of music's biggest power brokers. She's struggled with not just her own desire to grow musically, but the country music business's inclination to put women artists in a box, and a small box at that. All of that has led to Rose's new album, Have a Seat, which comes out this Friday. It's about accepting different viewpoints and trying to find the heart beneath the noise. She's done a series of videos for the album where different versions of herself hash it out around a big tape. After all these years, Maggie Rose is finally figuring out her place at the table. Here's our conversation. Maggie Rose, you're the first musician that I think has been on this podcast since people started playing live regularly again.
Wow.
And I know you've been doing that a bit. Let's just start off by talking about how it's different now than it was before.
Personally, it's different in how immense my gratitude is for what I do. I think I've always loved it. I've been doing this a long time, but the return to the stage makes you realize what an important part of the process of creating music that is. That's when you give the music away to your listeners, and that's when it really becomes real. And I think I just missed that. I didn't have my audience to really help me A&R this project, which is what I've had in all previous projects I've done, especially as an independent artist. That's such a big resource for me. It's also a huge way to connect and displace energy. So it feels just like a huge release. And I've also noticed the crowd, maybe this has always been there, but my perception of it is much more keen of how they are enjoying it and they are all coming together and how they're treating one another with a lot of compassion and joy. And it's just a really great time.
I know you said just a minute ago that your audience sort of A&R'd or that kind of helped you figure out, I guess by that you mean you tried out songs with them and figured out which ones worked and which ones didn't, right?
Absolutely. I think it's a great litmus test.
Right. And so how did you pick songs this time around when you couldn't do that?
Well, we still had conduits to our audience, I think, luckily through social media and just being able to do routine performances, because it was such a time of ambiguity during the pandemic that the one thing I wanted to provide my audience was some regularity. So every Friday we'd play shows, and I got a lot of feedback from people directly, individuals, just over social media. I also had a really wonderful team around me in making this project. Ben Tanner of Alabama Shakes produced Have a Seat, which comes out in August. And he listened, he was so patient, but this is what any good producer does. He really helped me curate this album.
And you recorded this in Muscle Shoals, right?
I did.
Now I've been there and I've toured the studios, and it's a cool looking place, but I'm not a musician. So I don't think I quite understand why people flock there to record and what about it makes it special.
There's a lot of spiritual elements that I think come into play. It's just like any great venue that an artist plays for the first time. I feel this way when I step on stage at Grand Ole Opry. You just are very aware of who's gone there before you, and it makes you step up your game. And that's the case with Studio A and Studio B at Fame Recording in Muscle Shoals, because you think of Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, the Allman Brothers, the Stones, you know, Bobby Gentry, and you just want to give it your all. And I think there's also the physical distance that I put between myself and Nashville and Music Row, where I've made all my previous projects, just to be able to take the 2.5 hour drive to this really beautiful, scenic, musically historic place. The band that I put together for this and myself, we had nothing else to focus on for the stretches of days that we'd go track there. It was all about the music, and we'd all go home at our Airbnb together and talk about what we were going to do the next day. And it was just like going to musical summer camp.
I wonder how much of that setting had to do with the results, because this record feels to me like, more than anything, I mean, I know we're going to talk a lot about genres and how they matter and don't matter and that sort of thing today, but more than anything, this feels like sort of a soul record, an R&B record. And I'm wondering if you felt it that way before you got to Muscle Shoals, or did Muscle Shoals sort of make it that way?
Yes, to both, because I went down to Muscle Shoals for this program that Hallie Phillips, Sam Phillips' granddaughter, puts together called Music Row to Muscle Shoals. And I did this around Christmas time of 2018. And just standing in that room with my band, performing a lot of the songs from my record that year, to Change the Whole Thing, I could see them all come alive. And I could see the way the audience was receiving this music and the energy that we all were putting out there together to put this performance on. So I think subconsciously, after I left, after that visit, it definitely colored the way that I wrote a lot of songs after that experience.
So you've put out, at this point, we're talking before the record comes out, a few songs already. And one of them in particular that I want to ask about is a song, For Your Consideration, which, and we'll get to in a minute, about a lot of the discussions and movements that you've made to be heard and have other women in Nashville be heard. This song feels to me, and feel free to tell me if I'm wrong, that you can read it on at least two levels. One is, it's a discussion between two lovers, and one partner's trying to tell the other one, basically, listen to me. But that phrase, For Your Consideration, reminds me of like the ads for the Oscars, where they're saying, basically, consider this movie, you know, look at us.
Right.
And that it feels like there's a level there where you might be talking about, you know, consider me as an artist, consider what I do and what I have to say. Is the read on that correct or close to it?
It's close to it. And there are many, the net that song casts is very wide. It was written during a politically contentious time. You know, we all know what we were going through in the last 5 years. And I think that definitely influenced how the song was written. I was in Los Angeles actually around the Emmy time when I got that idea, and I'm driving down Sunset and it's one billboard after the next just saying, For Your Consideration. And just thought it was such a humble way to ask for a vote, just to even be considered. And if we could provide that same empathy for one another, I think that we'd be in a much less sticky spot. It just felt like the rhetoric was becoming so polarized. And I'm not saying that we have to agree, but I think the most loving thing we can do is at least give each other the space to be heard. And then to your point, it was also after 13 years of making music that I think is really music of merit. And I've evolved, of course, and I've learned a lot of things. I'm still learning a lot, but it was my way of saying, this is where I land on the musical spectrum. This is my sound. This is not something to be missed. And I do feel like I've found my spot at the table.
The music on that track also speaks to some of that, because, you know, you live in Nashville. I think your at least beginnings were as a sort of a country artist, but that song sounds like, you know, has that R&B sound, has sort of an Amy Winehouse feel to it a little bit.
Oh, I love you for saying that. Amy's one of my favorites.
And I'm just wondering, was that sort of the idea too, that you wanted it to sound something different than what people might expect?
I wanted, of course, to touch on the soulful elements that you hear in a lot of the music that came out of Muscle Shoals and out of Fame Studios and make it contemporary, but it was pretty organic in how it came together. The verses are really sparse and super vulnerable. The dynamics of that, you know, it's like you have to almost lean in to listen to just that vocal and guitar line together, and a few other components introduce themselves later in the song. But when the chorus hits, it explodes almost like an argument that becomes unhinged, or that we lose control of, you know, where it just gets away from us and then we have to rein it back in.
This is all part of a longer conversation that I think you've been having with your audience and with the music industry for quite a while. It probably goes before this, but the first thing I thought of when I thought about talking to you were these things you did called Tomato Tuesdays. And I know that reference is going to make no sense to people who don't know the background. Could you explain a little bit about why, what happened, and why that particular phrase is something you chose?
I did start as a country artist in Nashville, and I still love so much of the history of country music. I play the Grand Ole Opry at least once a month. So I find that there is a place for that in my music, and there's a place for me within it. But when it came to country radio early on in my career, there was such an inequity, and there still is, of women to men on the radio. And one programmer who's pretty influential on the playlists of a lot of radio stations across the country, his name is Keith Hill. And he was not the only one who said this. He was just the one who was documented as saying it. But he likened women to the tomatoes in a salad, where we are accents and the men, our counterparts, are the bed of lettuce that we are just kind of sparingly tossed throughout. And that wasn't a great analogy. It's still one that is, it aged like milk, but that was the day that he said it. It was controversial. I think that anyone who says that there's a lack of female talent or a lack of any group of marginalized people providing good music is just not looking. And I wanted to show that every Tuesday I had another song that was in a form that I thought was good enough to present, that could be, you know, a contender for anything that was on the radio at that time. But it was also my way of busting out of the confinements of the genre that I had been placed in for so long, because at that point I didn't have anything to lose. I knew that it was not a meritocracy when it came to me releasing music to country radio. And I think that that problem is improving, but I also didn't move here to be a crusader for writing the ways of country radio. And I just found music and made music with people who were passionate about it. And it led me to so many wonderful places. But I also do want to keep those conversations going. That's why I started my podcast, The Songbird, where all my guests are women. And some of them are longtime established and icons in the industry. And some of them are people that deserve way more attention than they're getting.
Yeah. And I guess the other part of it is that maybe people who don't listen to country may not understand as well, is that, you know, we think about radio as almost being this sort of archaic thing now, but I guess in country music, that's still a really big deal, right? That's how artists get, they break out and that sort of thing.
I think that is the music grow mentality still very much. It's slower to evolve. But I think there's also so much goodness happening in Nashville. I love being a Nashvillian, because I think that my music has correlated with the evolution that I'm seeing in this town. Just the Americana scene, the root scene, rock and roll, blues music. Just it seems like there's such an abundance of resources for me to draw upon now that maybe were always there, but they're just more accessible to me.
Yeah, I've always felt like Nashville had a wider reputation or whatever than just being country music. So like when you go to the Grand Ole Opry, for example, do you feel like you can basically play what you want? I mean, do you feel like you have to be more country when you play the Opry or anything?
Well, there's a sanctity to the Grand Ole Opry that I always want to honor, but the way that they make me feel when I walk through the door is everything. And I think that that's what invites me to be my complete self when I'm on their stage, even with the reverence that I want to show. And it's really heartening to see people like Amethyst Kia playing there, and Allison Russell, and Nathaniel Rateliff, and Marcus King, along with Jeannie Seeley and Gary Muledeer, who's hilarious, and just the array of ages and we all have a place there is what I would very much like to see Nashville as an industry kind of mirror.
So you started out, as you said, you know, in Nashville doing country. Was that what you wanted to be singing at the time, or was that what you felt was the best chance for you to have success at the time?
Both. I was a teenager when I moved here, and I had a pretty powerful team behind me. And with that power also came obedience on my part. I was very green. You know, I think I was given a lot in the beginning, but maybe I was given that before I knew who I was. And then I had to deprogram a lot of that. And it was wholesome. It was the era of Taylor Swift. It wasn't the West Coast, far away from my East Coast family. So I think there are a lot of factors that played into it. And it did seem really accessible to me and authentic to who I was at that point in my life. The best songwriters that I ever met taught me like who I was in the beginning. It was a baptism by fire kind of experience when I moved to Nashville. But I do think that I was maybe a little bit of a late bloomer in a sense that I feel fully formed.
How did you get, I don't know if discovered is even the right word, but I know I saw in your bio that you were a student at Clemson.
Yeah.
And then the next thing I see is you're in Nashville. So how'd you get from there to there?
I know it's kind of the dartboard of life, I guess. If I have to explain it, it's difficult to do that because I was connected to Tommy Mottola through a family friend, Tom Mattelli, who is still involved in my career to this day and has been a mentor and just helped me kind of with some of these road bumps that I've hit along the way. But Tommy Mottola was introduced to me through Tom Mattelli while I was playing with a Bruce Springsteen tribute band whenever I could get to the Jersey Shore from Clemson. Again, this is the dartboard of life. I started writing original material when I was 16. And Tommy heard some of that and loved my sense of melody and felt like I could move to Nashville and start working with some great producers that he had worked with during his days with the Dixie Chicks. And that was my launching pad. And I was Tommy Mottola's girl.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's for people who don't know the music business, big time, I guess, ran Columbia Records, is that right? I don't remember that. And formerly married to Mariah Carey. So
that's how I described him to all my friends.
And did there come a point when you felt like you had to sort of kind of break away from the people who got you there or anything like that where you had to have, you know, obviously your music has evolved a lot and I'm sure it probably wasn't what the people who brought you to Nashville might have expected.
I'm not one to burn any bridges. And I think that all those years were so formative for me. There were a lot of things I think were backwards and maybe not prioritizing the music. But then again, this is also an industry to a lot of people who don't see it the way that I do. And I also had to figure some things out. I had to fall on my face a few times. I hit the reset button a couple of times in my career, not because it wasn't working, but because I wanted to further explore my musicality. And they're still there. I think they still wish me well, but we're doing different things. We have different objectives.
What are we fighting for? You're listening to the song, What Are We Fighting For? From Maggie Rose's new album, Have a Seat. When we come back, I talk to Rose about how the struggles of her career have been just as important as the successes.
The bad stuff is just as instrumental in the end product as the good is. So I think you need to absorb it all and use it all and put it in your music.
That and more ahead on Southbound. You're listening to a podcast right now, so I'm going to take a leap and say you enjoy podcasts. If you do, have I got something cool for you. This year's Charlotte Podcast Festival which runs from September 20th through the 25th. The festival is live at Spirit Square in Charlotte, but you'll also be able to attend events online. Keynote speakers include Jad Abumrad, the Peabody-winning host of the show Radiolab and the series Dolly Parton's America. There will also be panel discussions and seminars so you can learn how to create, distribute, and market your own podcast. It's an amazing event for podcast lovers of all kinds. I hope you join us. For more information, go to charlottepodcastfestival.com. And now, back to my conversation with Maggie Rose. You talked about hitting the reset button. Were there any times when you felt like, this isn't working out, I'm going to go figure out something else to do?
Yes. There was one dramatic, super dramatic day where my label folded. I had a song out at radio that I didn't necessarily want to put out, but all the research was so compelling. We had to do this. And I don't know if it was authentic to me, but it felt pretty desperate for the label I was at the time to have the single succeed. And again, those are pressures that don't really lead to the most coherent decision-making as far as like who you want to be as an artist. When you're super aware of the fragility of your label, you know, that's not the compass that I think an artist should be using to determine their next step. And then I had to move out of the apartment that I was in to downsize so that I could still live in Nashville. And I was sitting on this concrete floor.
All on the same day?
Pretty much. I mean, it was like,
oh man,
it was very quick where the rug was pulled out from underneath. And I was just sitting in my new shoebox apartment. I think I had to like build a closet around my bed so that I could fit all the things that I had. I was sleeping in my clothes for a period of time, but I still wanted to do this so badly. And then that is when the Tomato Tuesday event happened. That series was launched after all of this had happened, and I was truly fully independent for the first time at age 24, 25. And the music started pouring out of me, and there was just like this governor lifted. And I think that there's so many factors that contribute to that, but that was the moment where I realized, regardless of major label, indie label, doing this on my own, I want to be here and I want to do this. And there's so much left to discover. There's so much untapped talent and passion within me that I feel like I have to keep going.
I've always thought that anybody who does creative work that is, you know, presented to the public, stuff they're not just writing at home, has to have this like duality in their personality where you have to be sort of permeable in a way to let in the emotions of whatever it is you're writing about or creating or whatever. But then you have to have like this thick skin on the other side to deal with not just maybe criticism or people don't like what you do, but just sort of all the stuff you have to deal with in the business of that creativity. Was that something that you had kind of had when you got there, or have you had to develop that over the years?
I had to develop that for sure. And you know, I released some music as Margaret Durante, which is like my full birth given name. And I think for compartmentalization, and also one of the other times hitting the reset button, I was like, okay, let me try this again. Who do I want to be? Like, what do I want my listeners to feel when they hear this music and they see the show? And so I started going by Maggie Rose, which is a nickname that my dad always called me, and Rose is my middle name. And that felt like this armor that I had for a minute to just be able to have the duality that you're talking about. But now I kind of feel like those things have completely merged together, and I don't need to insulate myself from that, because the bad stuff is just as instrumental in the end product as the good is. So I think you need to absorb it all and use it all and put it in your music.
So in your podcast the other day, one of the episodes I was listening to, you're talking to this journalist, Kelly McCartney, who has been on both sides of the aisle, has worked with artists and that sort of thing. And she was saying something about how, you know, artists, man, they're pretty tough sometimes. And you kind of jumped in and said, yeah, we can be a handful. And it made me laugh But it also made me want to ask you, you know, how do you feel like you're a handful? And has that changed over the years?
I feel like I'm a handful to myself, just being this exposed nerve all the time, because our music is better for it. It can also be exhausting. And I think you need to understand, like, when you're being an empath, that you can't act on all of those emotions, even as intense as they may be.
So speaking of temperamental artists, do you listen to Cocaine and Rhinestones?
No, but podcast? I will add that to my list.
Yeah, it's a podcast. The host is David Allen Coe's son, actually. And the podcast is basically this sort of weird, quirky, and fascinating, his version of the history of country music. And the current season of the podcast is all about George Jones. And I'm getting to a question here, I promise. In one of the more recent episodes, he talked about George Jones sometimes dreading having a big hit record because he sang about stuff that was so emotional, so heartbreaking, those kinds of songs. And he knew if it was a hit, he was going to have to sing it 1,000 times, you know, every night on stage for the rest of his life or whatever.
Right.
And it made me wonder, someday to ask you, has there ever been a song that you felt like you were sort of afraid to sing because of what it might take out of you?
Yes, absolutely. I think, well, the reluctant feeling I had before releasing that one song at radio to help my label, because that was the key to saving us, that was not a great feeling. And there's always just a pit in my stomach before I sang it. But
so it was a song you didn't like, but you felt like they felt like that was going to be a hit for you or something?
I felt like I was a pawn in a bigger conversation that I didn't even get into the industry to conduct. So it was, you know, the bro country era. And here I am trying to have some kind of visibility in this landscape. And it was a very benign way of doing it, but it's called Girl in Your Truck Song. It just felt like the wrong time to do this. And it wasn't what I'm most passionate about and still isn't. So there was this feeling of compromise and selling myself short that I didn't enjoy. And I'm kind of relieved. I'm very relieved that it didn't blow up. There's some songs that I've released that I am almost grateful that I don't have to answer to today.
And how about when that idea of songs that may take something out of you emotionally, that, I mean, just because of the content of the lyrics or the way it sounds or whatever. I mean, do you find yourself singing stuff that at the end you're kind of wiped out?
Yes. But to me, that is also just the most exhilarating thing. It's somehow exhausting and life-giving at the same time. And if you can be a gifted enough performer to tap into that level of emotion every night that you're called to sing that song, then keep doing it until you can't anymore.
You've been working on this kind of changing not only your style, but trying to change Nashville and change that sort of thinking for a good while now. So where do you feel like things stand maybe for the kind of the music business and for you? Do you feel like there's been a lot of meaningful change?
I feel that there has, but also my vantage point has changed so much that I think it makes me more optimistic about it. I'm around people that I should be around. I was just at Newport Folk Fest last weekend, and it was like the biggest, warmest hug I've ever had. And that was my first experience there. So for me, the industry is changing because I am changing very much within it. And my place in the industry is changing.
One last thing. You are, you know, I'm trying to think. Your record may be out by the time this podcast actually arrives, but right now it's not out yet. And I know you've put out a few songs that people can hear. It's a little bit different than the old days when an album would come out and you wouldn't have heard anything on it.
Right.
But there still is that sense of anticipation, I'm sure, for you and how it will be received. And, you know, there's so many possibilities. It could be something that just is good and keeps your career going. It could be this gigantic hit record. It could be this bust. And there's, you know, there's all these different possibilities that haven't happened yet. And I just wonder if you could sort of describe maybe how that feels and how it may feel differently than when you were starting out.
I feel so completely alive right now in the anticipation of this record because I had so much of it done before the pandemic began. And then I realized just how incredible my situation was before the pandemic, all the things I was feeling like, why can't I just have this thing? And then I'd be set and then I'd be where I want to be in my career. All of that went away. So just the ability to make a record in such an historic place with such an incredible group of people from Alabama Shakes, from Them Vibes, there's just this gratitude that's absolutely, you know, like I've never felt before. But I also think that, you know, the uncertainty of it all is what makes this so exhilarating. And I think that that's why you make another record and then you make another record after that. It's always kind of pushing to see what how much more can we encapsulate our audience and how many people can we reach? So it's the risk that makes it so exciting. That's why it's fun.
Is it like love? Do you know when you know?
This is one more song from Maggie Rose's new album, Have a Seat. The song is called Are We There Yet? What does it mean to find your voice? We're all born talking in one way or another, but finding your voice as an artist is a twofold thing. It's not just figuring out your authentic style, it's discovering what you have to say. It took a long time for Maggie Rose to find her voice. It didn't happen until she fought back against the country music establishment and the way it treats women. Who knows how it'll pay off commercially? She made a good record. But lots of people make good records that never become hits. The difference is that this time, she made the record she wanted to make. After all these years, she found her voice. And that's something that should bring some hope to all of us. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.